Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Bonulli. Today is January 9th. We have Professor Barry Eichengreen and Ira Harris. Professor Eichengreen is Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley, former senior policy advisor at the International Monetary Fund, IMF. He's the author of many books, including most recently, In Defense of Public Debt. Ira is a hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bond commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and a stint also most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks for me as well.
Great. I thought we'd begin, Professor Eichengreen, your macro view of the global economy.
There are a lot of pundits out there predicting recession or predicting lack of recession. I don't think any predictions can be made with confidence at this point. Matters are finally balanced. The new development, of course, is that China has lifted its zero COVID policy and is opening up. That's interpreted as bad news for the Chinese economy in the short run and good news for the Chinese economy in the longer run. So I think the consensus view is that China will now experience a severe slowdown that might last for 3 months as COVID spreads and people don't go shopping, they don't go to work, a lot of things don't happen, that the equivalent of herd immunity is reached after that and the economy bounces back very strongly. Could be, but I think that's a very, very risky strategy. Large numbers of COVID cases together with individuals with immune systems that are impaired to various degrees, that's a recipe for new variants. So existing variants are consistent with that forecast for a V-shaped recession in China and strong recovery in, say, the last three quarters of 2023. New variants would not be presumably consistent with that forecast. So I think there is a serious tail risk there that the slowdown in China is longer lasting and more severe than many people currently hope. Beyond that, I don't think there is news on the global front. Europe is being helped by relatively mild weather. The United States is being helped by a well-behaved labor market, but things could still go wrong. Winter has only begun in Europe. Purchasing manager surveys in the US are very, very negative. And there are festering problems in low-income countries. So I think the situation is hard to forecast and very complicated.
Yeah, interesting. A lot of moving parts here. Thoughts, Ira?
No, I think those are all very good points, and it is a frustrating thing to listen to a plentitude of pundits talking about recession, no recession. I've been doing this for a long time, and I have no idea. I read people who are, I think I have a lot of respect for, and they don't know soft landing, no soft landing. So where does it go? I don't know. Now, of course, for the no recession, as Professor Eichengreen points out, we have those who are now, China is now going to, with all the massive amount of savings that have built up, just like in the United States, when people couldn't go out and freely spend and they were locked up, that there's going to be this massive amount of tourism that hits. I don't know. Nor do I really believe that anybody else knows too. We're going to follow. I'm much more a believer in the interest rates. I do think that Friday we did see something. I think that the markets actually put the bit in their mouth, and I'm speaking from a market participant here, is that we saw the PMI services go under 50. It was a one-time, one-off event, maybe, but it has been the critical criterion that Powell has continually brought to the fore. That so even when manufacturing was weakening a little bit, services were holding up so well. So now we got a little chink in that armor. And interest rates in the U.S. especially came off quite a bit. Where this will lead, I don't know that either. But it's going to be a long year. There are so many, as I would say, piles of tinder that could be ignited that will throw everybody's forecasts off. So I think everything that Professor Eichmann, I agree with everything.
And similar to the recession, no recession views, there's the question of inflation or disinflation in the first half of the year. Do you see that, Professor Eichengreen, or what are your views on inflation throughout the year?
A variety of indicators do show inflation moderating, but inflation moderating is different from inflation coming down to levels that are acceptable for the Fed. So I think many observers and markets have gotten ahead of themselves in thinking that the Fed is going to stop raising rates, the Fed is going to pivot, the Fed will take what Ira referred to, 1P purchasing managers survey, and decide that's enough evidence to halt the hiking cycle. I would expect them to continue to raise rates. I still think by 50 basis points at the next meeting. I still expect that the terminal level will be a bit above 5%. So I don't think the Fed is done, unlike some people in the markets evidently do. And because of that, I'm not as pessimistic about the dollar as some people are.
Mm-hmm. And how does that translate to views on the middle and the long end portion of the yield curve?
Well, if the middle and the long end of the yield curve, I think, are going to depend mainly on how the real economy responds, and it's too early to tell. Mm-hmm. So that's a academic way of saying I don't know.
No, that's okay. Yeah. Yeah, your thoughts, Ira?
I don't know. But here's what I'm, and the issue for me is that if rates stay high, and I'm not talking about a pivot. Well, I don't know where this binary outcomes of pivot or point. I'm much more interested that the Fed pauses and kind of waits to see, number one, the impact upon the labor markets. And it's interesting that there now are a lot of labor economists sitting at the Fed, Lisa Cook, Philip Jefferson, Leo Brainerd, I would certainly put in that camp, Susan Collins. And I hear very little concern about the impact from the Fed maybe going a little too quickly here and its impact that, yes, we've seen these jolts numbers. I'm kind of lost as to when they became such a dominant piece of the puzzle, especially because from my talk to people in the tech world, the jolts are stale because a lot of people now get paid for clicks at jobs, looking at job boards. So people don't, so it's not on the job board's incentive to take jobs down because the more you have there, the more people come and click and the more money that they're making. So I'm a little skeptical on that, but I am really concerned about, well, if the Fed does just pause, if they just pause, which is fine, let's see where this goes. But I'm very concerned about the rise of the interest costs on our present deficit and how that will impact many, many things. The politics of it, to me, are going to be very, very ugly. And will it then turn people away? If you're concerned about the US debt load, and I'm not talking about the private load here, I'm just talking about public, will it then move people away from the dollar? Because we've seen that before. If we want to go back in the 70s when rates started going higher, the fear of U.S. debt and U.S. debt was nothing compared to where we're at now. It raised concerns, even as you were raising rates. The dollar was weakening. I mean, this is when I came into the business and actually had left graduate school studying these elements. So I walked right into it. It was very interesting to see. So I would turn that back to Professor Eichengreen, whether there was any concern about that.
Yeah, my Berkeley colleague, Christina Romer, gave the presidential address at the American Economic Association meetings a couple of days ago on Saturday. And she looked at the impact of monetary tightening, negative monetary shocks on, among other things, the labor market. She showed that by the standards of previous negative monetary shocks, this series of interest rate hikes is a big negative shock. And if historical regularities are any guide, it could translate into a noticeable rise in the unemployment rate. So all of that is consistent with Ira's point that there are reasons for concern. But there are two issues to be distinguished here. What should the Fed do? What will the Fed do? And I think the Fed, having fallen so far behind the curve early last year, is concerned above all to regain its anti-inflationary credibility and worried that if it does pause and inflation doesn't continue its rapid descent, that credibility will have been permanently damaged or diminished. So regardless of what it should do, I think what it will do is continue to raise rates at the next meeting. And after that, it will look at the data.
Your thoughts on that?
Well, no, I'm glad, because I actually read Christina Romer's piece over the weekend, because I'm a big fan, because anybody who Tim Geithner has such disdain for, I automatically have to hold up in a very high regard. And I thought she was, Washington misses her, because I think she's, but it was interesting to read that. And that's really, you know, I've been kind of perplexed by that, that there aren't any dissenting votes at the Fed, because dissenting votes at the Fed would tell me more than all their forward guidance or dot plots, because it would signal that, well, you know, maybe there are some other viewpoints here. I also follow quite a bit Dean Baker and Mark Weisbrot from the CEPR, and they've been on this, that inflation is lower than you think. Now that's, again, their opinion, and it's a very informed opinion, and it's their view that maybe you want to take a slowdown here. And then you get it from the other side too, which was kind of interesting, that Sheila Bair and Bill Gross, you know, talked about, so, you know, you might want to see some of the effects here, because there is a lot of leverage in the system. And it's not all, you know, everybody talks about how wonderful the banks are and what great shape they're in, and that Dodd-Frank has done his job, but there's still an enormous amount of leverage in the system as a result, of course, of 14 years of Fed policy, but more importantly, the greater dynamic of fiscal and monetary stimulus through the COVID period. So we just don't know. And that may be the most interesting. And what caught me at the last Fed meeting, because Steve Leisman asked the first question out of the bat was to Powell about, well, you know, Wall Street sees loosening financial conditions. But Powell said, no, according to the Fed over the last year, financial conditions have tightened and are still tightening. So what will that impact me? I don't know. Not that that's how you should set monetary policy, not in my estimation anyway. It's not, can't be solely for financial conditions. There's a lot of things that get hidden there, but again, we'll see. And we'll, you know, what will be the cost of financing and all the debt, and where will we really feel it and see it?
Yeah, I do agree that financial accidents happen at times like this, when interest costs are going up and the economy is slowing down. Those are enough observations to make you worry about the stability of different pockets in the financial sector. The banks are strong, but the non-bank financial sector, we don't know, because as recent events have reminded us, the non-bank financial sector is not especially transparent. I don't think that these risks will deter the Fed from continuing to tighten as necessary, but they will make life exciting for the rest of us.
Yeah, that's true.
Turning over to China on their currency, you've written recently about how they could become a reserve currency without fully liberalizing capital markets. That's always been a big question. Do they need to liberalize the capital markets to get to that point? Your thoughts on that, Professor Eikengreen?
China has taken various steps to encourage banks, firms, and governments abroad to settle transactions using its currency. A lot of those transactions are trade related and not subject to China's capital controls. Others are connected with its Belt and Road program. So there are channels through which it can encourage cross-border use of its currency without a full capital account liberalization. And it has embarked on partial capital account liberalization, as you know. So it has permitted a broader range of financial transactions by and with foreigners. So with my co-authors, that was a Center for Economic Policy Research paper, we did suggest that there is some scope for continuing to internationalize the currency in the absence of full capital account liberalization. And the financial sanctions imposed by the G7 plus countries on Russia, I think, will at least modestly accelerate the adoption, the use of the Chinese renminbi by countries that are not especially friendly to the United States, by non-aligned countries that worry about their dependence on the dollar and weaponization of the greenback and the U.S. banking system. So none of this is to say that the renminbi will suddenly overtake the dollar as a leading international and reserve currency, but I think there is some scope for its continued internationalization, even in the absence of full capital account liberalization.
And in that regard, do you see from all of the geopolitical events and risks, a bifurcation of the global economy into the Belt and Road Forum countries? You mentioned Belt and Road versus like the World Economic Forum countries.
Yes and no. So no, my base case would be no, I don't see such a bifurcation because, for example, the United States and China are still one another's number one or number two trading partners, that the interdependence of the two economies is still so great. So China is our number one source of laptop computers, game consoles, lithium batteries, a whole range of other things that we value, and vice versa. They depend on us for a lot of stuff, even in the aftermath of the new controls that the Biden administration has imposed on exports to China of high-tech equipment and designs and so forth. So I would expect to see the two monetary and financial systems, one centered on the dollar and the US, the other one centered on the renminbi and China, to overlap, and a lot of countries to have a foot in both camps. So a lot of, a number of big Western banks that do lots of clearing in and payments in New York and London through chips and chaps. I always like to say that. Yeah. Also do some clearing through the Chinese cross-border interbank payment system centered in Shanghai. So my base case would be one where the two systems overlap if there was a complete political breakdown between the US and China, really a new Cold War, or worse still, a shooting war over Taiwan or something. Then the world would break into these two blocks, there would be no atheists in those foxholes, if you will, and non-aligned countries would be told by Beijing and Washington, you're either with us or with them, and that would include either with us or with them monetarily and financially.
Yeah, that all makes sense. Your thoughts, Ira?
No, it's very interesting. I as I listen to this, and I know one of the things I've read to Professor Eichengreen for all these years, because I come out of the realm of political economy, and I really believe that's one of the great strengths I think of the Berkeley School, to tell you the truth, that there are a lot of people there who really put this together. And it's interesting that you talked about the Center for Economic Policy research, but where do you see, because the way that I look at this world, you know, everyone's just looking at China, but yeah, I go back to a piece that Olaf Scholz from Germany wrote, well, it's in the current Foreign Affairs, talking about the Zeitenwende. I don't speak a good German, but he's not the only one, because there was a piece from my favorite Japan watcher at Observing Japan, picked up on Zeitenwende too, following the BOJ and everything that Kishida talked about, that, you know, the upping defense spending. So you are at, and I think that's right. And I think Olaf Scholz, I know he's protecting his political rear, because he's made some really bad appointments, but he had to put together that stoplight coalition. But are we at a turning point? And as you bring up the role of the renminbi, where does Japan now fit in here? And yes, they've been a U.S. ally, but the Japan currency in any measure that I put together is very, very weak. On a relative basis, you know, currencies are always relative basis. So it's very weak, and it gives them, because of their high level of already engineering and technological expertise, a critical leverage upon the world. And, you know, everybody who comes on CNBC, not that I watch it anymore, I don't, it's... it's gotten kind of silly in a lot of ways, but they all talk about, well, this is going to be great for the U.S. defense industries, and I don't believe that for a minute. I think that's where the Zeitenwende really takes place, because Japan now becomes a competitor of building defense systems for themselves and then for export to the world. So we're going to go through a lot of changes. How do you see that?
So Ira, you raised several different issues. One is the role of geopolitics on international financial markets. And I view the increased prominence recently of geopolitics in shaping financial outcomes as back to the future, as a return to normalcy. So the abnormal period was from the fall of the Berlin Wall until fairly recently, when geopolitics were not so prominent in shaping monetary and financial developments, but throughout history before that, they were. So we're now back in that world where what currency central banks hold as reserves depends not only on interest rate differentials, but who their geopolitical allies are. That was true in the past, and those kind of factors will be important in the future. So the fact that many financial market participants could ignore geopolitical developments or not attach much weight to them in the 1990s and the early 2000s, that was quite abnormal, and that era is over. On the role of Japan, unfortunately, I think the world is going to need more in investment in defense-related stuff, and the U.S. cannot carry that load by itself. No matter what Mr. Scholz says, Europe is unlikely to carry most of that load. So there is room for Japan, with, as you say, its technological expertise, to contribute to that process of ramping up defense spending, which in practice means spending on high tech stuff. And on the weak yen, the Bank of Japan has been an outlier until now, in that they have reason to still be fighting the last war. But now that inflation is apparently up above 2%, that era may be coming to a close as well. And the fact that we would not be able to count on the yen continuing to weaken if the BOJ pivots will have implications for the direction of capital flows and so forth.
So, I mean, to finish up this segment, but I always, one of the critical relationships for me as a trader and an investment is to look at the yen-yuan relationship, because there is, that's a reality, how that breaks down and what will take place if there is a live fire situation in Taiwan, that that China breaks its long held about a waiting for time just to deliver Taiwan back into the People's Republic of China. And that changes, then we'll see a change there anyway. But I always look at that relationship because there's so much of Asia pivots around that relationship. And I still see, even when the yuan gets, because of the weakness in the yen, I'm looking at now, there's 19 and a half yen to yuan or renminbi, if you so choose. And those are at, probably close to 30-year highs. We saw that, one of my favorite place in time is when in June of 1998, when Bill Clinton was going to Shanghai and Beijing, and the United States found a way to intervene on the yen because the yen was getting too weak and the Chinese were none too happy. And that relationship got to a little bit over 20 yen to a yuan. And that's when the United States, with the Bank of Japan, of course, intervened in June, July. Then the yen started to weaken again. Then they came back for it. So I think that relationship has great credibility because the Chinese have told us it has great credibility. And to me, when the Chinese tell you, you should pay attention to that relationship. So will we see a little bit of a change in that? I don't know. It's just one more of those geopolitical, political economic, not geopolitical, but political economic barometers that we need to continue to focus on.
And what about on Europe, Professor? I can agree in your thoughts there. The bond market challenges there, and in terms of the policymakers having control over whether their economy's rebound continues. You wrote about this 7 or 8 months ago, just wondering your current thoughts on that.
So I think Europe has a hard road ahead. As I said earlier, it has benefited from a relatively mild winter. It has been able to fill its energy reserves to fill the tank more successfully than many people anticipated. So the early part of the winter hasn't been as devastating socially and economically as we feared. But these problems will persist throughout 2023. And as you said before, slow growth and elevated debt ratios don't go together easily. So part of the problem is that Europe doesn't have a lot of policy space, doesn't have monetary policy space because of elevated inflation, doesn't have fiscal policy space, except in a few notable cases because of high debt levels. And the fiscal policy space it has not always been used sensibly. So capping energy prices as opposed to giving households relief checks and letting energy prices rise to market clearing levels where there's an incentive to conserve is not the best way to to use your firepower. So I am worried about European prospects going forward.
Interesting. Your thoughts, Ira, on Europe?
I worry about Europe too. I think people are much too sanguine on the outcome, only because you have 27 nations, 19 currencies, a central bank that is political, probably far more political than it is economic, in my estimation. They can keep raising rates. And to me, as I listen to Christine Lagarde, who is a master politician and she wasn't brought for her financial acumen, I don't believe. She was brought for her political ability to tie this together, but it gets more difficult. And even Klaus Knot, who is the president of the Dutch bank, said a week, 10 days ago in the FT, which really caught me by surprise, that he said that because the ECB doesn't report its vote. But he said more than a third of the members wanted a 75 basis point increase. But I think that Christine Lagarde plays a game here, which she has to play. I'm not criticizing her. I think she's that she would rather raise interest rates than really embark on an active quantitative tightening, because the quantitative tightening could throw, as she learned when she her first month in her position, could throw fragmentation of the European debt markets right to the forefront. And I think that's her greatest fear, because then we go back to what we endured back in 11 and 12 and 13, when, you know, people forget German 10-year yields were 40% when there was a fear of their debt overhang. Now, you know, then of course it prompted Draghi, but they were 40%. And even French rate, you know, there was any sense of fragmentation. And the fragmentation, meanwhile, increases because the market is going to push on the ECB. Once the ECB actually stops buying the longer end of the curve, and you see it now, the curves in Europe are far more interesting. German curve is inverted. But the other curves, France is now back to flat, but the other curves are steepened because that's where you go to sell. So Europe has some really, they're not out of this yet. Not as people think. I saw the news today. Oh, their economic numbers were so much better. Okay, they're not economic. They've got a lot more on their plate. And that's, you know, we go back to Olaf Scholz. He has to deal with German domestic politics, and he has that group who keeps going back to Karlsruhe to go to the German Constitutional Court every time they think that the ECB is falling afoul of the Lisbon Treaty. So Europe is, I'm agreeing totally, Professor Eichengreen, it's going to get, they're not out of the woods in any way, shape, or form, but it does raise a question. We had this question, Professor Eichengreen, the other day, on a podcast, and the question arises, can Germany economically advance without China? Because they've tied themselves, so, which you talk about, and I know you've read, so I've read several of what you've written about with China. So can they make it without China?
Well, I would rephrase the question. Can they make it without China, without cheap Russian energy, and without the internal combustion engine? That's a lot of withouts.
Do I see a picture of Gerhard Schroeder in the back? No. Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I agree, the ECB has a harder task than the Fed, even, because inflation is higher, growth is weaker, and debt levels are dangerously high in a number of Southern European countries. To that, I would add the fact that the ECB has a much larger and unwieldy board. You know, there are more than 20 people around the table when it becomes time to vote. You know, the governors with a vote do rotate, but there is a large number of voices, which makes developing a consensus, even for an ECB president with political chops, difficult.
Interesting. Professor Eichengreen, a couple months ago, you wrote about the trilemma of central bank digital currencies. Can you elaborate on that? And also, will it be possible for central banks to balance confidentiality of transactions and financial stability?
Yeah, I do think there are important trade-offs there, that if the central bank issues CBDC, that can't be tracked and that can be used for whatever, that will jeopardize our conventions about know your customer rules and anti-money laundering rules. If the central bank issues wholesale CBDC that's used only for transactions among regulated financial institutions, then this problem of compliance with know your customer rules goes away. But the argument for a wholesale CBDC is basically Web 3.0, that it is designed as a platform, this wholesale CBDC, for smart contracts, self-executing financial transactions. And I think there's a real question about whether central banks want to enable the kind of financial business, licit and illicit, that would go on in a Web 3.0 world. So I am supportive of the Fed's approach of going slow. And I think those who argue the Fed needs to move quickly, because otherwise China and the People's Bank of China will set the standard for central bank digital currencies in ways that favor the renminbi and disfavor the dollar. I think that argument is basically oversold. I don't think CBDCs are going to be used for cross-border payments in large amounts anytime soon, so the Fed can continue to move in a deliberate fashion, which is what it's been doing.
I see. Very interesting insight. Your thoughts, Ira?
No, it's all great points, but I would just ask a question, and it's very self-serving of me to ask this, because I have an investment in a company called Ninth Gear, which has developed blockchain technology for crushing, as they came to ask me when they wanted some advice, because I have long established as a foreign exchange trader and I have regulatory experience, and they came to ask me about it, because what did they want to do? They wanted to minimize Herstatt risk and take a two-day settlement and reduce it to basically 15 minutes, which in today's world, with 3.0, you know, why not? So will digital coins become more readily credible in a blockchain type world where you could, you know, secure it with your own personal identity and you would be the holder, which would be a return to, you know, putting our stock certificates in our safety deposit boxes?
Yeah, I always like to draw two distinctions. Distinction number one is between three kinds of digital currencies: plain vanilla cryptos, stable coins, and central bank digital currencies. I think only the third has legs. Plain vanilla cryptos have these volatility and transparency problems, of which we've been reminded by recent events. Stable coins are subject to bank run style threat unless they're over collateralized. And if they're over collateralized, they won't scale. They'll be expensive to issue and hold. So I think at the end of the day, it's only central bank digital currencies that will rule this domain. So that's distinction number one. Distinction number two has been between central bank digital currencies and blockchain. Some people say cryptos are ephemera, but blockchain is here to stay because it can be used to execute transactions quickly at low cost in the light of day, insofar as everybody can trace on a public blockchain what is being done. Again, I'm not convinced yet that in the financial sphere, certainly most of the applications of blockchain that we've seen have been pilot projects that haven't gone anywhere, rather than impressive demonstrations of the power of blockchain in the financial sphere.
If I could ask one follow-up question. So, but to gain credibility, like let's say for the Chinese central bank digital coin, and even Lael Brainard, when she laid out the Fed's view on, I think it was her initial paper on maybe two years ago already, on digital central bank digital currencies, she made the case, and my eyes crossed when I read it, that gold would have a role as some type of collateral base to it to give it more credibility. And I thought about that. It was interesting coming from her. For the Chinese or for the Russians, they would certainly need almost, Keynes's bankor, and that's what people have talked about, that there would be stockpiled commodities that you would have a call on it. I don't know how that would possibly work, but have you heard that discussion being elevated at all?
No, I have not heard anybody talk about that explicitly. There is an analyst at Credit Suisse who's talked about a new Bretton Woods with commodity backing for currencies and so forth. I think those ideas are still too underdeveloped to be taken seriously. Collateral has to be liquid. If people are going to hold your stable coin because it's fully collateralized, then if they want to redeem it, you have to sell some collateral so you can pay them off. So holding collateral in illiquid form, and not all commodity markets are adequately liquid, will create redemption risk, and that will limit the appeal of such units.
Interesting. And just a final question or topic, Professor Eichengreen, on this issue of like reshoring to the U.S. Industry and manufacturing. Do you see that happening, or maybe in the future? And would it necessarily come to the U.S. or Canada, or could it go to Mexico more instead?
A lot of production exports from Mexico to the United States are already a big deal. So I was smiling because we made a small purchase of a flat screen TV for the kitchen, small purchase of small TV for the kitchen. And it was a Korean brand, South Korean brand, well known, produced in Mexico. So a lot of this, occurs already for good economic reasons, that shipping costs are lower, time involved in shipping is lower, labor costs are lower. So I think they're, given the problems that we have seen with containerization and so forth, a bunch of companies are going to be shortening their supply chains and locating more production close to the final market. But what we've seen, insofar as there has been any movement of iPhone production away from China, it's not been toward Mexico, it's been toward Vietnam and India and so forth. So I think globalization as we know it shows no signs of disappearing, but it is being reconfigured, mm-hmm. at least modestly.
Oh, that's good insight. Yeah, exactly. Your thoughts, Ira?
I think that's absolutely right. And you see it now because, there's been a lot of discussion about rebuilding the chip industry in Japan. I mean, it's one of the things that makes me ultimately bullish on Japan, because they have a lot of ways to take advantage of, to me, a severely undervalued on a relative basis currency. But at Mexico is one of those stories, it's always waiting to happen, but the corruption angle just prevents it. I think you would have, they built the maquiladoras, you know, back in the 90s or 80s in anticipation of NAFTA and all of its implications. Of course, the Chinese, the day NAFTA started, the Chinese depreciated the renminbi, yuan, 50%. That must have been just by coincidence, but it stole a lot of that thunder. So we're still waiting to see that, but we're seeing all of that. So yeah, I have nothing.
I think it was revealing last week, if I recall correctly, that the head of Taiwan Semiconductor celebrated the fact that they were proceeding with the construction of a chip plant in the U.S. Southwest, either in Arizona or New Mexico, and he acknowledged that the cost of producing chips was likely to be twice in the U.S. what it is in Taiwan, both because Taiwan has more experience, more workers experienced in doing this stuff, and they have built the very large fabs already that are needed to do this. So that's an indication that you can reshore such production to the United States, but at very significant additional cost, which means that it's not going to occur big time under current conditions.
Yeah, I think that's right. And they're building in Arizona. I'm in Arizona, so it's a big thing here. So.
Any final thoughts, Professor Eichengreen, and how can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work?
Well, I have a website at the University of California, Berkeley. So my name is in the lower right-hand side of the Zoom box, so they can Google or equivalent that. And I do a monthly column at Project Syndicate, as you kindly mentioned earlier, with a new one coming out in a couple of days.
Great. And Ira?
You usually hear, or, you know, I do put out some blogs, still not as frequently as I did, because honestly, I've not really seen much change. There are potential changes, but I like to do these podcasts. It gives me this is really a great honor to be able to sit with Professor Eichengreen. I trade day in and day out, probably over trade, but that's the curse of all these years. But I'm willing to discuss things. These are great, because I think we were really able to ferret out a lot of ideas, and you know, and nobody's selling anything. So
great. And Ira's blog is iragharris.com. Well, thank you so much, Professor Eichengreen and Ira, for the insightful discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. It was great. Appreciate it.
Thank you, gentlemen, both.
Thank you.
Yeah, my question. Take care. Thank you. Bye.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.